Okay, we're now recording. This is David Anderson. I'm here with Eugene and our father, Henry Anderson. It is July, sometime in July 2014.
It's the 14th.
It's Bastille Day. You can always remember.
It's the 14th of July.
That's right.
Okay, Henry. Go ahead.
Well, this is going to end up, I hope, with a coherent account of how I got to be where I am today. A bundle of likes and dislikes and quirks and prejudices and all kinds of eccentricities. And in order to arrive at that end, I feel I have to say a few things about my family background. I don't want to be doctrinaire about it because I'm not a Freudian. I don't believe that all of my faults at the present time are due to my parents. I'm a believer in some considerable amount of free will and personal responsibility. However, there can be no doubt that I've been influenced in some ways by my ancestors, so I'll say just a few words about them. My paternal grandparents were both born in Sweden in the mid-1800s. They both emigrated to the United States in the 1880s. How are we doing?
Good.
My grandfather Anderson was a tailor by trade. I think self-employed his entire life, and he was not terribly successful at it. My paternal grandmother was a homemaker. When she was a teenager, she was in domestic service. After she got to the United States, I guess she was probably doing the same thing until she met my grandfather. And then from there on, she began having children right away. And I think from then on, she was a homebody the whole time. But when times got tough, as they did, I imagine she made a pittance by taking in sewing at home, which is about all that women of good repute could do in those days. And the first child was my father, and he was named Oscar after his own father, Oscar Albin Anderson was his full name, born in 1890.
Where did they live?
He was born in Champaign, Illinois, and rather soon after that they moved to Iowa, Davenport, Iowa, which is where he grew up. And I venture to guess that at a tender age, probably by the age of 6 or 8 or whatever, he tried to help the family income by selling newspapers or running errands for druggists or whatever he could get. The more important point, I think, is that for the first 6 years of his life, they spoke nothing but Swedish in the family home. And when he was required to go to public school at the age of 6, he was forced into what I guess they call total immersion. There were no classes in English as a second language at that time. He had to pick up English as best he could by just listening to it being talked in the classroom. But he was apparently a smart little fellow, and so he learned English. And then he began teaching English to his parents, so that within the space of a few years, and by the time other children came along, he had three sisters and one younger brother. They were all speaking English, and by the time I eventually met my grandmother, she was speaking English better than most English speakers. Uninflected. She spoke it very well. Now, I know a good deal more about the background of my father's side of the family than I do my mother's, even though they were all old stock American. But Sweden was more civilized than this country in the respect of public records. So I know a lot about how they got here and the ship that they sailed on across the Atlantic, etc., etc. My mother came from Southern stock. She was born in a little town in Texas. I believe it's on the Red River between Texas and Arkansas. Born in 1896. Town was named Bonham. I've never been there. I have been to Davenport, but not to my mother's birthplace. Her father was a stockman. He raised horses, thoroughbred horses specifically, which is significant in that it involves a totally different social milieu than being a plantation owner, where you have a lot of hands and that led to what I call a plantation mentality, which felt that the owner was naturally superior to the hands, and it, of course, flowered during the period of slavery, but even after that, in sharecropping and various other devices which perpetuated the caste system. I don't know that my grandfather even had any year-round hands to help him with the horses. I don't know that much about him, actually.
What his name?
Pardon me?
His name?
His name was Henry Pope. And I've tried to do a little research on the Pope line, but haven't gotten very far. There was a general in the Civil War named Pope, but I think he was on the Union side, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a dead end. In any case, my mother's mother died when she was 2 years old from typhoid fever, because at that time they didn't have indoor plumbing. They didn't know or didn't believe in the germ theory of disease. And I'm sure the outhouse somehow leaked into the family well, and it killed her. My grandfather remarried, but it was a marriage of convenience, just so that my mother would have somebody to take care of her. And about, maybe when she was 5 or so, they moved to a town called San Angelo, where she went to high school. And I assume, once again, the records are not at all clear. I am assuming that she graduated at about the age of 18, which would have made it around the beginning of the First World War. And she has talked to me about her life to some extent. But then there's a period of several years, 4 or 5 years, that are very opaque, because she apparently was suffering from some kind of disease, perhaps respiratory in nature. So she didn't go to school and didn't have any employment, as far as I can tell. But after 4 years or so, a doctor said that what she needed was a change of climate. The climate in San Angelo, and in fact in Texas as a whole, was not good. They figured that she needed a dry climate. And so she decided that the University of Arizona filled the bill. And in 1918, she began at the University of Arizona in Tucson.
And we're talking about Ethel, your mother, Ethel Pope?
Ethel Pope, okay. Correct. And in order to keep the story of the two sides roughly contemporaneous, I need to go back and say a little more about my father. When he got out of high school, once again, I'm assuming about the age of 18, which would have made it approximately 2008, he had to drop out and work to help the family. And as best I can figure it, he did some kind of social work in the city of Chicago. And maybe he saved up enough that he was able to start thinking seriously about college. And in 1914, he began going to a small liberal arts college in Iowa called Cornell, no connection with the university, in Ithaca, New York. And he was very successful in sports, in social affairs. He was very active in the temperance movement. These were the days in which there was a very powerful movement in favor of passing an amendment to the Constitution known as Prohibition, which outlawed the sale of alcohol. And he believed very passionately in that movement. In 1917, the war in Europe had been going on ever since 1914, but in 1917, in April of that year, this country entered the war. And apparently, my father enlisted in the army rather than waiting to be drafted, because that way he figured that he would be able to get his choice of branches of the service, which is in fact the way it worked out. He, during his years at Cornell College, was taking courses that he thought were leading him toward going into medicine. And it's very interesting for me to think about how different my life would have been if my father had in fact been a physician. But of course, if he had become a physician, I would not have been born. So that's just fantasy. He hadn't turned 18 until October of 1918, which was just a year before the war was over. And if he hadn't enlisted, he might not have had to go into the army at all. But as it was, he was in fact assigned to the medical corps, which is what he wanted. But he hadn't reckoned on what that entailed. And he got into the war on the continent of Europe, where poison gas was being used by the Germans. And even though he wasn't on the front lines being exposed to it in that way, the men who were exposed were brought back to the hospitals, and one of them, where my father was stationed, inhaled a good deal of that, and he inhaled enough of the residues of the poison gas that it affected his lungs and apparently affected him in one way or another for the rest of his life. And among other things, it made it impossible to take lab courses of the sort you would have to take in medical school, and he had to give up any idea of ever becoming a physician. After he was discharged, in fact, he spent a year and a half or so recuperating and went back to Cornell to get his BA, but he got it in English. And when he graduated in 1922, having taken out time for service in the army and then recuperation afterwards, he was considerably older than his classmates. And he began looking for a job immediately as an English teacher, and found one in a little town in Arizona called Globe. It was in the mining region. Now, just about this same time, Ethel Pope was graduating from the University of Arizona looking for a job as an English teacher. And lo and behold, she also got a job in the English department of the Globe Arizona High School. And she met this young, well, actually, Oscar Anderson was not that young by this time. She was also older than her classmates at the University of Arizona. So I think they were both close to 30. In any case, they found that they had a good deal in common. They both believed in the temperance movement, which was still strong, even though by this time prohibition had been passed, because a lot of people weren't paying any attention to the prohibition movement. But Ethel Pope and Oscar Alban Anderson were also interested in outdoors, hiking, nature studies, astronomy, and so forth. And one thing led to another, and in the year 1924, they were married. And both of them had saved up enough money that they could begin talking seriously about his moving on to graduate studies. And it was assumed that she would start having children and would become a housewife. Now, at that time, the best school of education west of the Mississippi was at Stanford University. And my father applied for admission there and was accepted. So that in 1925, he began his studies there for a master's degree in education. And in January of 1926, they had a child, and he was a male child, as the firstborns in the Anderson clan were usually male. And they named him Oscar Alban Anderson also. So he was junior and his father became senior. And it was close to graduation. Well, he was due to graduate in the spring of that year and was looking around for employment. And among other places, applied for something in Texas. I don't know how many other places he might have applied, and I don't know exactly what terms they offered him, but apparently he had no trouble getting that job because the reputation of Stanford was such that it gave them some bragging rights, I suppose, in the little town of Mahia, Texas. It's spelled M-E-X-I-A. They pronounce it Mahia, the way people in small towns frequently take it upon themselves to pronounce the name of their town the way they please, whether it has any relationship to the way it would be pronounced by anybody else. I think the correct Spanish pronunciation would be Mejia, but Mejia is the way they pronounce it and the way people in Cairo, Illinois pronounce their town Cairo anyway. In the fall, I guess it was September of 1927.
Was it a high school teaching job?
He was the principal of that high school. That's the reason why he took that job. I'm sure it paid a good deal more than they had ever been making as teachers. So they moved, and my mother was pregnant again at that time. So in December of 1927, she was delivered of another male child. This time, I was born at home. Her first pregnancy was in the hospital at Palo Alto, and it was a very difficult delivery. She was in labor for 48 hours or something of the sort. Fortunately, the second delivery is usually easier than the first, and that was the case with my birth. I think she had a midwife. She may have had a midwife, but that was it. And she had, I think, she had a live-in helper, a colored woman, as they would put it in those days, to help her with these two small kids. My father had a 2-year contract with the Mejia High School, and it terminated in the spring of 1929. And according to some rumors, and I can't put my finger directly on any of them, the parting between my father and the Mejia School District was not altogether amicable. So I have a standing joke that whenever somebody raises their eyebrows when I say that I was born in Texas, everybody assumes, since I was raised ever after in California, that I must be a native-born Californian, but no. I always joke that I left the state of Texas as soon as I reached the age of reason. I was 1 3/4 years old when they moved back to California. And back to the same house, which they had bought when he was studying for his master's, at 2741 Copper Street in Palo Alto, right near the city limits, semi-rural really. they rented it out while he was on this 2-year contract with Mahea. And this time he re-enrolled at Stanford in the doctoral program, once again in the School of Education. And I think that he had a particular interest, in fact, I think that the whole department had a particular interest in starting education earlier than most people assumed. Some school districts had kindergartens in some of their schools. Palo Alto may have had in some of its schools. But nobody was talking about anything earlier than the kindergarten. And I think that in the Stanford University School of Education, they were already talking about nursery schools, or what later became known as Head Start programs. Nobody was actually doing it at that time, but they were talking about it. So my father got interested in that. I think it was going to be the subject of his doctoral dissertation. I can't be sure about some of these things. In October, just a few months after, maybe 1 or 2 months after they moved back to Palo Alto from Texas, the Great Depression began, October of 1929. And I think it hit my father, because I have heard from some of my mother's recollections that he, like almost everybody else in the country, thought that the stock market was going to continue going forever upward. And he bought stock on margin, as they call it, meaning that he went into debt by a stock called International Telephone and Telegraph, and was wiped out. Well, this combined with the fact that he had this interest, this intellectual interest in the concept of nursery schools, because of a combination of factors, and I can't be sure of how large each one played a role. In any case, my father and mother began what they called the Anderson Nursery School in their own home in Palo Alto, probably in 1930. And she would maintain it during the day. He helped by building a jungle gym, a swing set, a sandbox, a marimba, a big stand-up marimba, probably 3 octaves or so. He was very good at woodwork, and he could work with metal, and he had a lot of interest and a lot of skills. And furthermore, there were faculty members at the university who had children of an appropriate age, and through his contacts, they were able to start school children from the faculty at the Anderson Nursery School, even though it began very small. And I don't know, I don't have any idea how much they charged, but it was enough to pay the expenses of the materials for the play equipment and feeding them at noontime and so forth and so on. And my mother had some help for a time, and they had the colored woman, so to speak, from Mahaya that came with them to help with Oscar and myself, Oscar Jr. She had to go back to Texas, but my mother was able to hire a woman who lived in one of the houses closest to us to help with the scut work of...
Do you remember that woman's name?
Her name, yeah, sure. Her name was Nellie Ellsworth. Her husband was Charlie Ellsworth, and he was a carpenter by trade and an excellent carpenter, but in the Depression, he couldn't get a job. And he was grateful for whatever my mother was able to pay his wife to do the cooking and dishwashing and stuff like that.
That's the local.
Pardon me?
That was the local woman from who lived in the neighborhood?
Yes.
What about the woman from Texas?
She went home.
What was her name?
Oh, her name was Cornelius. And nobody ever called her by her last name, and I don't know what it was.
And you were 4 or 5 at this point?
Well, you can figure it up. In the year 1930, most of the year, I was still only 2. In December of 1930, I would have become 3. So I was probably able to mingle with some of her, the children of the Stanford faculty. They probably were admitted to the Anderson Nursery School at the age of 3, as long as they were housebroken and stuff like that. Now, my mother was pretty much on her own as to how to run a nursery school. But she figured out that the children should be, it wasn't just a matter of babysitting. It was a matter of stimulating them in various ways. And so there was always music as part of the day's activities, including playing the marimba with some nursery song, and the children would sing along with that.
I remember talking about that marimba.
Really?
Yeah.
Pardon me?
I think I remember her talking about the marimba.
Oh, sure. It was a big deal. It was a beautiful piece of work, as well as very useful in the curriculum. The curriculum of the Anderson Nursery School. And then, of course, there was a lot of reading. Always something of interest, and probably not just pap, but reading of, with some merit to it. And then very, very valuable playtime. It was more than just recreation. It was a matter of getting along with other people, a very important aspect. In fact, in ways that it was not anticipated. It seems that many of the members of the Stanford faculty, particularly those in the psychology and education departments, had problems. The children, they were problem children. And it was thrown upon my mother to figure out how to cope with them and get them working and playing together. And she had some kind of intuition. That she was able to prevent a kid who was a bully from acting like a bully. He was allowed to do so in his own home because they thought that, this was in advance of the theory that you don't, you don't be tough with your child. You're liable to damage his psyche. And so they just let, so many of these faculty members let their kids do whatever they damn well pleased. And some of them were just spoiled rotten. But my mother had a technique, and all I can do is guess, because I was a little young at that time to see it actually be put into practice. Although she tried to put it into words later on, she said that she had and exercised what she called the voice of authority. And she, for example, if a child used a bad word, and incidentally, one of the words that I learned at an early age was a bad word, was the word nigger. She would not allow us to use that word. And so if a child became overbearing and tried to push somebody out of the way or tried to grab the last cookie or whatever might be objectionable, she would say in her own way, "We don't do that here." And it worked. I don't know. I don't recall that she was ever able to use any of the cliched methods of sending somebody to a room without any lunch or anything of that sort. It just worked. And so the Anderson Nursery School thrived. And I thrived. I got along well with others, and I was learning to appreciate music to the point that I would begin making up little nursery songs myself. And it wasn't just a matter of listening to her read from the Mother West Wind stories and so forth to the group. But in the evenings, at bedtime, she would read to my brother and myself, as we looked over her shoulder at what she was reading. And so we began to learn, which leads me to the subject of my entry into the outside school system. As it happens, 2741 Cowper Street was one block away from the South Palo Alto Grammar School. And I don't think that at the time they bought the place back in 1924 or 5, whatever it was, that they had in mind that that was a very convenient location. I think they bought it because it was very reasonable, being well out of the tony parts of Palo Alto. As I say, this was semi-rural. We were surrounded on many sides by fields, open fields, directly across the street from us. There was an entire city block, absolutely vacant, except every year a crop of naturally self-reproducing wild oats would spring up, and somebody who had a permission from the owner to do so would bring in a team of horses and a device which cut down the grain, and when it dried in the sun, he would bring in another team of horses and with a big rake, rake it up. And so there was this elementary school that had the first six grades. Wait a minute, I'm sorry. It had the first eight grades. It was a two-room school. Grades 1 to 4 were in one room, 4 to 8 in the other. They had one teacher in each room. And they were single women, as almost all grammar school teachers were in those days. Many school districts had regulations against teachers marrying on the theory that they would naturally start having children and would drop out, and they would have to go out and recruit somebody else, and it was better to have, keep them single. It was a different age in many ways, believe me. So that raised the question, as I figured out later. I was not a party to the discussion. The question was, at what age to enter me in the first grade. Being born in the month of December, it was an awkward time. People usually began in the first grade at the age of six. Well, I turned six in December. When I would have been considerably older than another six-year-old who had turned in the middle of the year. On the other hand, if I entered at the age of five, I would have been much younger than my classmates. So I was entered in first grade at the age of six. No. Yes. I remember now, yeah. I don't remember, but I'm now figuring it out. I had turned six in 1933. And of course, by this time, I not only had an advantage over many of my classmates, that I was a little older than many of them, but I had had the advantage of years of preschool education. And all that they could think of to do with me is to skip grades. And I suppose that the teacher, her name was Fadjo, must have talked with my mother about what they were proposing to do, saying that I was just wasting my time with kids who didn't even know the alphabet, whatever they begin teaching in the first grade. So my mother agreed that I would skip the first grade. And that worked for a year or two until I guess by the time I moved from one room of that two-room school to the next, beginning with grade five, the teacher of that room, her name was Somerville, complained that I was so far ahead of the other kids in the fifth grade that I was wasting my time with them, and she wanted to skip me another grade. And I'm assuming that once again, she must have had the permission of my parents, and she talked them into it. So now here I was, two years ahead of my classmates in terms of my age. I mean, 2 years behind them in terms of my age. I was there equivalent in terms of my grasp of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And this has colored my whole life ever since. And there has got to be a better way to deal with that problem.
You would have preferred that they not skip you.
Well, as I say, there. There must be a way to keep a person intellectually active.
Even if he's ahead of his classmates?
Yes.
Well, it's a recurring problem.
Yes. So, on the plus side of the ledger, I will say this about my classmates. None of them ever looked on me as being some kind of a freak. None of them resented the fact that I was given certain privileges. Well, for example, my mother went to visit her relatives in Texas during the school year of 1936. So I was given permission to go on a vacation of 2 weeks. And, of course, nobody else was given that privilege. But nobody seemed to resent it, and when I got back, I was called upon to give an account of the things that I had done and experienced. And I was greatly impressed by the fact that I was able to eat off a menu 3 times a day. We went back and forth by train, and it was a trip of at least 2 days each direction. So I got all these meals off of a menu, which I considered to be a great treat. It was like going to a restaurant 3 times every day, and a restaurant in real life was a rare event in our household. So I reported on all this. I was well accepted by that class. And I want to say another thing about the nature of the South Palo Alto Grammar School. I would estimate that 50% of my classmates were of brown complexions. They were Southern European in extraction, all of them being born in this country, as I later figured out. The nature of the agriculture in South Palo Alto was dairy farms, primarily, rather than crops of the type that require seasonal labor. This was in the middle of the Depression, when some parts of California had a terrific problem with Dust Bowl refugees, and literal wars between workers and employers. In tree crops and row crops, but they didn't have that kind of a problem in the dairy industry. So we all got along beautifully together. One of my best friends was a Filipino. Another was a Portuguese in extraction. They were all native born. We didn't have any problem with newcomers because they weren't allowed out of the immigration policies of that time. But they wouldn't, there was no magnet for people to come from Mexico into the United States at that time because there was a surplus of labor already here. And one other point worth mentioning is that perhaps my best friend in the whole group was a girl, but not because we were boyfriend and girlfriend in the usual sense. I had much in common with her because she was a tomboy who was interested in sports. And I was interested in sports because my father was interested in sports. And so we had much to talk about. She, of course, was 12 years old. When I was 10 years old, I was prepubescent, where she was fully pubescent. But I never thought of her as a girl in that sense.
What was her name?
Her name was Joan Puttkamp. An unusual name, but another interesting aspect of that friendship was that we discovered halfway through the school year that she came from the neediest family in the entire school, which she managed to keep hidden. But at Christmas time that year, and this was 1937, somehow or other she learned their address and got together a bunch of Christmas presents for my friend Joan and her sister Louise and brother Bill. And we drove by this place to deliver them. And I don't know how we found it, because it didn't even have an address sign on it. It was a tar paper shack. They were really destitute. So it didn't make the slightest bit of difference to me. My mother took it upon herself to see that when I did activities which she thought might be pleasurable and educational to Joan, she invited her to go along. And for one example, I took horse riding lessons, and she took part in those, and that was greatly appreciated. Somehow or other, she was able to convey all of this without a sense of noblesse oblige. I remember also from those years that men would occasionally come to the back door of the nursery school and would knock and ask if we could spare a sandwich or something. And my mother always did. And we'd invite them in and invite them to sit down at the table and talk while they were eating the sandwich or whatever it was. And I found that I'm sure that was unusual.
You mean your mother would encourage them to talk about what had got them where they were? And
yeah, she would ask them to talk about whatever they wanted to talk about, which frequently was their life story. And and in ways such as that, I developed, I guess you could say, a social conscience without it ever having been flaunted. My father was a conflicted man. He had great difficulty at Stanford in his doctoral program. Because he developed a writer's block. I don't think that he had to write a thesis to get an MA at that time or in that school. I got an MA in a professional school at UC. I didn't have to write a thesis in public health. But in the PhD program, he had to write a dissertation and he wasn't able to buckle down to it. Years went by. During a good chunk of those years, 2 or 3 years at least, he had a very good job in the Palo Alto Unified School District as the assistant superintendent with the expectation that when he got his PhD, the incumbent superintendent would retire as he was getting long in the tooth and my father would take over as superintendent. Well, it didn't work. As time went by, it became clear that he wasn't going to be able to finish that. I think he ran out of time. They probably had a limit on how many years you could spend as a candidate. And so there was a time when he was let go as assistant superintendent. And the only job he could get in the district was as teaching wood shop in a night school class. Very humiliating, very humiliating. And at the same time, my mother was making a fabulous success out of the Anderson Nursery School, which was humiliating to him, I'm sure, as a matter of male pride. And to make a long story short, things became tense at home. And I wasn't able to do anything about it. It made me uncomfortable, of course. happy. Another complicating factor in my years during that period of time, early 1930s, was that my mother wanted very badly to have a girl child after whom she would be able to name her mother. I mean, to say her, she planned, if she had a girl child, she was going to name it Mary Alice, which was her mother's name. And along about 1933, I guess it was, she did become pregnant for the third time and had a child who seemed at first to be healthy and was in fact a girl. But there was some kind of congenital malformation, probably involving the heart, which required the ambulance to be called several times. There's a great deal I don't remember about those early years, but I do remember that. And then the child died. It might have been earlier than 33, I don't remember. My mother became pregnant once more, a fourth time, and this time it never even came close to term. There was a miscarriage. And her gynecologist said that if she were to become pregnant again, it might very well endanger her own life. And so that was the end of the physical relationship with my father. And that added to their estrangement. And in looking back on it, it seems to me that it would have been very helpful and healthful to me if I had had a sister, because I would have learned on a day-to-day basis how to deal with a girl as a real human being, rather than what you see in the movies or fantasize about. So when the time came that I had to deal with a woman in real life, I didn't know how to do it.
Well, you'd have this friend, but I guess she was an atypical.
That wasn't
very, yeah,
boy.
Yeah, No, no, I never got the knack. I either thought of women as being on some kind of a pedestal or else. Well, what's the old dichotomy? Madonna and whore. That's stereotypes of one kind or another.
Pretty much sums it up. how are you doing, Henry? How's your energy?
Well, it's almost 7, so...
Should we break for a couple of questions?
If they are brief, because I'm almost finished with this chapter.
Oh, okay. Let's keep going.
Well,
a question or two, possibly, but yeah, just finish your narrative.
Okay, in 1935 or so, my brother and I both had tonsillectomies. He needed one because he was frequently getting inflamed upper respiratory infections of ear and nose and throat. I wasn't, but in those days they believed in yanking out tonsils on a preventive measure, which nowadays would be a no-no, because any operation is subject to something possibly going wrong. Anyway, we both had our tonsils yanked out at the Stanford Hospital. And the doctor suggested that during a recuperation period, we ought to look for a better climate during the summer than we were going to get in Palo Alto. As you know from reading Mark Twain, the coldest winter he ever spent was summer in the San Francisco Bay Area. And somehow or other, I think through a contact with a fellow named Fran Binkley, who had been at the School of Education, my parents learned that there was available a cabin that they could rent for the summer, because the climate up in Lake County was high and dry, warm, ideal for what we boys needed. And so my parents got the idea of combining that with the nursery school in the Anderson summer camp. And that would open up the next chapter of my story. But if there's something that you wanted from what I've said so far, I could do that in the next couple of minutes.
Well, what sports had your father done at Cornell College, and what sports were you interested in junior high school?
Interesting question. He was very active in on the track team at Cornell and was apparently pretty good at it. And in the year 1936, took me to a track meet at Edwards Field here in Berkeley, and I believe it was a lead up to the Olympics that were being held that year in Germany. And I, if I if my memory serves, I even believe that Jesse Owens was involved in that track meet. In any event, it absolutely sold me on the whole subject. And in the last year that I was at the South Palo Alto Grammar School, I talked the teacher into letting me put on a track meet of our own with improvised quarter mile, which in fact turned out to be probably closer to 220 yards around the schoolyard, and so forth and so on. And the other kids entered in good spirit. And of course, at high school, I went out for track, but that's getting ahead of the story.
Other sports?
I never was good enough. Or big enough. I certainly wasn't tall. I certainly wasn't heavy. And ruled out a great many things. I was a shrimp.
So it was Messi.
That's right.
About the same size as Henry, you think? A little bigger.
Messi's shorter.
Really?
Yeah.
So you mentioned the being younger than your classmates, and you said that the plus was that they were nice to you. What were the minuses?
Pardon me?
You mentioned that your classmates didn't hold your youth against you. You said that there was that plus, but you never completed that thought with what were the minuses of having skipped two grades. Were there any minuses?
Oh, well, I'll give you another example of the way I was favored. I was given permission to go home one morning, at least for an hour, every week to listen to a radio broadcast about music. And that developed my appreciation of music other than nursery rhymes. And I still don't quite understand why the others didn't look upon me as being the teacher's pet. And teacher's pets are not usually looked upon favorably. And yet I don't recall there being any resentment.
Hmm.
How many, you said two rooms in this school, and how many students?
Maybe 60, divided 30 and 30.
Right.
Just a guess.
But just two, one main teacher in each of these rooms?
Correct. Oh, one other thing I neglected to mention, and then maybe this will be the last. During the years that my father was, maybe I, I'll say two other things. One, in the normal course of events, you would expect that my brother and I, being so close together in age, would have gone to the same school. In fact, we never did. He was considered to be the brains of the family and was sent to private schools. To develop his scientific bent. I was the aesthete. I was expected to be interested in art and music and that sort of thing, whereas he was into science and math. And science and math required a better quality of education than I could get in the public schools. The second point I started to make before I got distracted, God, what was it? Well, nope, I've lost it.
Well, another question about the nursery school. Was that a separate building?
No. I can't really understand how we were allowed to get away with it. Because it was all done in a very modest bungalow. Two bedrooms and one bath. And the kids had to have some place to take naps, and I don't know exactly where that was. Nowadays, it would have been shut down immediately, I'm sure.
There's a few preschool. No, I went to a preschool that was in the woman's home.
Yeah.
I mean, there are regulations, of course. What was the typical number of students in the nursery school?
Probably 8.
Is that good? Should I turn this off?
The other thing that I almost forgot is that during the last year or so of my father's tenure as assistant superintendent, one of his duties was to personally visit every classroom in that district to just sit in the back of the room and observe the way the teacher was handling her duties. And so in due course of time, he would come around to South Palo Alto Grammar School, and there I was, trying to pretend that I didn't know him. At the same time, I was very proud, because that was a heck of a good position to be, and it's another one of my conjectures of how different everything might have been. And to wrap this whole thing up, and this is positively the last, if my mother's pregnancy with Mary Alice had gone as everybody hoped. It probably would have meant a hiatus in the Anderson Nursery School of a year or so, at least, and very possibly that would have made such a difference in my father's morale, and that he was once again in the position of being the breadwinner of the family, etc., etc., etc. Everything might have been different. Mm-hmm. So that's it for the day.
Very good.